So we're here to talk about getting ready to play at a jam session, which leads me to believe that everyone in here has been playing for a while and feels like you're good with playing some songs. You maybe do most of your playing at home, and you're ready to kind of get out in the world and see, how you're doing.
I've been playing for a while.
What's that?
I've only been playing for a couple months.
Long. Okay, so you're looking. Oh, but did you play anything before?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you're ready to go out there and
play some rolls
at that. good approach. So here's when you guys went out last night to the jams after the concerts. How many people here went to the slow jam? Okay, intermediate jam. Okay. What else was there? I know you weren't. I was the fast jam, so I know you weren't there. Right. How many of you went to sleep?
And this does say your first jam.
Yes, right.
That's the name of this workshop.
That is the name of this workshop. Okay. Yes, that's what I'm. That's what I'm after. What I discovered more and more with students, actually, more because I was looking for it than anything changed, is that there are certain skills that you develop by sitting at home and practicing, however diligently. And there are certain skills you don't develop by doing those things, no matter how diligently you practice. And those things get exposed the first time you get out with a group of people and you try to do the things that you've been doing with all that diligent practice. So what I wanted to do, besides choke on the water, what I wanted to do was point out what those things are and try to come up with some ways to either practice them or to at least be aware of what they are before they kind of slap you in the face when you get out with a bunch of people. So most people, when they get ready to do their first jam session, have been playing for a while. 2 months is within range. 2 months, a year, 2 years, maybe. If you've been playing for over a year, chances are you're ready. Whether you have the confidence to feel you're ready or not, you probably are. But what you're ready at doing is the things you practice. Maybe you've worked out, learned some tunes from Tab, you know them, you know how to vamp, you know how to roll chords a little bit, and you just walk into a jam session, like down here, and Casey Henry says, okay, we'll do Rolling My Sweet Baby's Arms. And at a slow jam, at something like this, she teaches you the chords, she teaches you the melody, and you go in and play the tune. And so things start. Let's just kind of skip over that part, because that's already happened. The tune starts and you start playing. Let me ask another question. The ones of you who were here last night for jam, how many of you were at your first jam? Anybody? Oh, good. Good. I got a lot of people to ask them. So when you first started playing that first tune last night, what were you doing?
Square roll.
Square
roll.
Okay. What were you doing?
I was, because it's claw hammer, so I was just trying to find chords.
Okay. So you claw hammer, right?
Yeah. But, quite honestly, it was a disaster. When they hit the rare song that I knew,
right,
it was a lot of fun. And then the ones that I didn't, I was watching other people's hands, and I was just just trying to figure it out.
Right.
And
okay.
That's why I'm here.
The melody breaks that I know I've been working on.
So when you got to a break, how did that go?
It's pretty good, but it's easy to hide in
20 or 30 players. Yeah.
When you play like the D to the G, it all sounds the same, and it's just
okay.
You sound better than.
Okay. Well, here's the first thing that happens to a lot of people, and I didn't elicit it from you, so you're good, so that's fine. A lot of people have the experience that they'll be in a jam early on. Someone will call a tune they know. They'll call Fireball Nail, and they play. I listen home all the time, so cool. The tune starts. Comes around to you, take your break, train wreck. Okay? Nothing's working. Nothing lines up. Here's what generally happens is you've been playing at home. You learn from tab, you play on your own, you settle into a tempo. You play the tune for 6 months. Every time you play it at the same speed. Right? You play it so much at that speed that the speed actually becomes part of the tune for you. You're not playing Fireball Nail, you're playing Fireball Nail at 103.5 beats per minute. That's the title. And so you show up in a jam session and somebody calls Fireball Nail and you say, cool, I'm going to play Fireball Nail. And you launch into it at 103.5 beats a minute and they're playing at 100 beats a minute. And even though they're playing slower than you normally play it, you're a measure into the tune and you're already a half beat away from it. And you can't get back. Right? So what happens? You try to slow down, but your playing style is so connected to the speed that you play that when you try to change your speed to match the group, first of all, it's a different tune. It's no longer what I said before. But even your core playing style is tied to that speed. And you end up sort of tripping over your own fingers trying to keep things in line. So the most important thing that you can do when you're getting ready to play out, when you're getting ready to play with other people, is start playing and force yourself out of your comfortable speed. And I wrote a whole thing a couple of days ago that's in this handout about playing with a metronome. Everybody get a handout? Okay, I've got more up here. We're not going to, it's for later. So I wrote this whole thing about playing with a metronome because I've said this for years and I've never actually written it down before. But the idea of a metronome, the metronome will accomplish two things for you. It'll make your playing more accurate. And it'll force you to tempo. So you want to use it both ways. And this should be a part of your regular playing routine. Maybe not every day, but do this every once in a while. More if you're having trouble with it. Here's what I do. Take the most comfortable tune you play. The tune that when you start practicing, you take the banjo out of the case, maybe warm up with a few rolls. What's the first tune you play? Use that tune, record it on a pocket recorder or something. Take the metronome and play back the recording that you made and match the speed of the metronome to the speed of the recording. So you've played, you've warmed up your sort of your comfortable place with the banjo. Play the best version of it you can into the recorder. Find out what speed that is. Now, remember that speed is going to vary. Nobody except a robot can play it absolutely the same tempo all the time. So you're never going to absolutely match it. But just come close. You'll find, you know, within a notch or two, within maybe two or three beats a minute, what speed that is. Write that down. Set the metronome to that speed, either that time or the next time you practice. Warm yourself up like you always do. When you get to that song, turn on the metronome at that speed. and start playing. And here's the thing about a metronome. If you've never played to a metronome before, it's a pretty bewildering experience. Because, like I said, everybody varies speed a little bit. And when you vary speed with a metronome, what happens is that you're hearing everything together, and then you speed up a little bit, and you're hearing, and they get further and further apart. So you have to compensate. Now, in real life, if you're playing with a guitar player, the guitar player is going to hear the same thing. And they're going to be on the other side of that. They're going to be on the slow side of that mismatch. So as you're slowing down to catch them, they're going to be speeding up to catch you, and you'll meet in the middle. With a metronome, that doesn't happen. So all of the job of getting back to time is on you. And so it's actually harder to play with a metronome than it is to play with people. It's one reason people hate playing with metronomes, but it's worth it, trust me. So when you are playing, come on. Yeah, there it is. There's so much stuff on here I can't find it. So let's say I'm going to set this to 110 beats a minute. So there's 110 beats a minute. And there are two things. There's one important thing about a metronome besides being able to keep time. You notice every fourth beat sounds different. And that's going to be the downbeat of each measure. When you play to metronome or to anything, you have to match not just to a beat, but you have to match to the right beat. And with a metronome that doesn't distinguish between beats, it's really easy to slip a beat. You go so far off that you're better off just keep continuing, catching up to the next beat and catching. So you want to hear that 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. So everybody, when they play with a metronome, even professionals, have a period of adjustment before they get used to it. You take the instrument out of the case. You're cold. You're not used to the discipline, and so you just play it. So you play Fireball Nail. And what you're trying to do. Try to make the metronome click disappear into your playing. You hear that. So I've been playing a lot today, so I'm kind of already a little warmed up. But when I started talking to you, I lost track of where the metronome was, and you heard that sound. But the rest of the time, what you try to do is make the sound of the metronome disappear. So here you are now. You're playing your favorite tune. You're playing it at your favorite speed. And after about 5 minutes, you're locked. You're just locked into that beat. And everything's great. So what do? You take the metronome, and you drop it 4 beats a minute. And you turn it on. And you start playing Fireball Nail. And it's like it's a whole different tune. It's happened to everybody. And it takes you 5 minutes or so of playing at that speed before you've adjusted your hand motions to match that speed. So you do that, you get your confidence back, you go back up 4 beats a minute, back to where you started. Turn it on. It'll sound as much as that was the speed that you started at, that you really liked the song at. You go back to that speed, and it's going to seem just as far in as when you went away from it. because you just everything. Music is all about being used to things. It's I know I say it's about tension resolution, but it's also about habit. And so when you hear something, it makes sense. When it changes, it doesn't make sense anymore until you adjust to it. Once you adjust to it, the old way doesn't make sense anymore. So this can be about a 10 or 15 minute part of your practice. Less if you don't have the time for it. So play at your comfort speed, slow it down a little, get used to it, go back to your comfort speed, get used to it. Now, here's a little bit of a payoff. Speed it up 4 beats a minute. Okay, 4 beats a minute isn't much. It's enough to throw you off. But if you can play at a given speed, chances are you can play 4 beats faster. So do that and take your 5 minutes and get used to that speed. Now you've just gained a little bit of skill. You just gained the ability. If somebody kicks the tune off faster than you're comfortable at, you know you can get there. You know you can play that. So metronome, as much as it's not anybody's favorite tool, it's definitely worth doing that kind of exercise to get used to it. And what it'll do for you is it'll get you to the point where maybe it'll take a minute or two or instead of five to get used to a different tempo. Then it'll take 15 seconds, and then you'll just settle right in. And at that point, you're not going to have that train wreck feeling when the tune starts and it comes around to you at the wrong speed. So metronome is really step one. I'm gonna go just a tiny bit off topic to talk about something that I think will make that even easier, and that's a right hand technique. That's how you play. You actually a clawhammer player, or were you playing bluegrass? And you
I did
back?
A little bit.
Yeah. Oh, so this I don't want to leave you out.
Okay.
Most people, if you they're just starting out and you look at the way that they're playing, the way the right hand is moving, what you see is inefficiencies. It's hard to play really efficient right hand. And when I say inefficiencies, what I mean is when you play a note, you want to be able to get back to the point where you can use that finger again as efficiently as possible, with as little effort as possible. Effort is changing direction or going further away from the string than you need to. There are lots of ways that you can be inefficient, but there's the most efficient way that you can play strings is by moving your fingers in a circle. And so, really quick, think of it this way: think the top of your hand shouldn't move. Everything moves from the knuckles down, and for your fingers, think about pedaling a bicycle. Right, your fingers are going to go around in circles, because the best thing you can do as far as follow through and as far as smoothness is circles, because circles never stop. Right? So your hips, knees, ankles, and just make a circle with those hips. And over time, work on getting those circles smaller and smaller, and you'll get it. Your playing will sound better, your notes will sound more connected, but you'll also you'll also be able to play faster. Smaller circles, less distance, more speed. With your thumb, start from the wrist. Same thing, circles like you're spinning a pencil. Just like Leah's doing today. She's had this lecture. See you later. And so that gives you the same thing. And when you're playing, don't think of each of your notes as a separate action. Everything overlaps. Your fingers are always moving. If you're playing three notes, you're playing thumb, index, middle in this period of time, and each of your fingers is moving individually, they've got to move pretty fast. But if each of your fingers is moving for the entire span of three notes, moves a third as fast, gives you a lot more speed, a lot more control, and a lot more ability to play fast, to play, to make these adjustments to match the speed of who you're playing. The other thing that happens, and this is also related to the circles and to the metronome, is that when you're playing in a jam session, especially one like we've had, in, you know, like yesterday, where there are 20 or 30 banjos, you've got to play loud. Right? There's no way you can even hear yourself in the din. So when you start playing louder, if your technique's not good, you're going to play louder in a completely different way than you play soft. Okay? Okay.
I'm going to tickle.
Okay.
Sorry.
Come on back when you're...
Yep.
So when you try to play louder, if you try to play louder by playing faster or by playing harder, it's the same situation as playing at the wrong speed. Right? Your right-hand technique goes completely out the window. If you're playing circles, what you do is just dig a little bit deeper. Right? What makes a string louder? It's you're pulling a little further off center before you release it. So if you can control that within a circle, you can basically not change your right hand technique at all, almost at all, but make yourself louder or softer. So either just move in on the strings a little bit more, which will catch them and carry them further. Or just, when you play the circle, just flatten it out at the bottom a little bit more. Let it carry the string and then drop it. So, I'm not going to go into this, but I have an exercise that I give people called the neutral roll. We're just playing 5-3-1 over and over. And one of the things that I tell people to do with the neutral roll, and it's a great way of working with the circles and making sure things overlap, because you've got nothing else to concentrate on except how your right hand is moving. So one of the things I do with that is just work on playing louder and softer without changing anything. And you get used to the feel of it. And it just works for you. So there's another practice technique, and it's good for your overall technique, and it's also going to help you when you're playing with other people. Because what's the big difference between playing in your living room and playing in a jam session? It's when you're in your living room, you're in complete control, right? There's nothing going on that you're not doing. When you're in a jam session, you're completely out of control. Right, you can play your own notes, but everything else that goes on in the room, you just have to react to. And it's that time that it takes to react. For the first few jam sessions, it's chaos. Chaos in your head, and you just have to deal with it. What you can do at home, if you're sort of bored with playing with a metronome, and if you want to pick up material, pick up repertoire, take your favorite CDs and pull your favorite songs off of the CDs. It helps if they're songs that people tend to play in jam sessions. And make yourself a custom CD for practice. If songs are on there a little bit loud, get yourself Amazing Slowdown or Audacity or some software that will change the speed. If they're a little off pitch, you can change the pitch. Record them to a CD that way, or record them to an MP3 playlist. And when you practice, just run through them. And don't be afraid to, when you get to the end of a song, to say, I could do that better, and hit rewind, or hit back, and play the same song again. This is an advantage you have at home that you don't have in a jam session. You get do-overs. So as part of your practice session, get used to playing with recordings. Recordings have a huge advantage over metronome in one way. They're real. So you have to get used to not only playing the tunes, but playing them with the variations in speed that are on the recording. The downside of it is that every time you play that recording, it's going to have the same variations in speed in exactly the same places. And you know, the only thing worse than learning Fireball Nail at 103.5 beats a minute is learning Fireball Nail at that speed that speeds up to 106 in measure 16 and slows down to 97. And, so you want to vary the stuff you're playing too also. But it's a really nice way to practice vamping and to practice backup, and to, you just play breaks over the recording. And for years, that's the way I practiced. I just grabbed a pile of CDs and put them on, skipped around to the songs I knew I liked. So these are things you can do to change your practice regimen to make your playing with real people work better. The other thing is start small and just find one person who you can play with. Find a fiddle player, find a guitar player, find an adventurous bass player, and get yourself a real person to play with. Going to a jam session, getting into a jam session is totally about confidence. And so confidence is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. So all these coping mechanisms are supposed to help you settle in. When you get into a session, the first thing you want to do, particularly if it's a big session, you can get away with it. But even typically, the first jam sessions people walk into, if they're not in a camp like this, they'll be at a bluegrass festival, and there'll be a crowd of people around a campfire playing. And you say, okay, I know that song, and I'll give that a try. The best thing to do, and this is not just practice technique, but also jam session etiquette, is for a little while, until you gain confidence, stay on the outside. And do the stuff that's most comfortable for you. So start out just vamping. Maybe put in some rolls after you. Doing those things will give you a sense of the rhythm sense of the jam session. Everyone has the experience that they hear a jam session, they're doing great stuff. They're doing a song that, I know that, I want to play on that. You get close to the jam session, you realize that it's unplayable. That what's going on in the jam session is just, it's six guys who get together every Saturday night, and they're used to each other, and they've been doing it for 30 years, and they're used to each other's shortcomings. And you get close and say, okay, maybe I'll go down that way. So doing the vamping gives you sort of the best of both worlds. You can be an observer because they don't know you're there, or because basically they don't care. You're not being obtrusive, you're not disrupting them, but you're getting a sense of what it means to play with that particular group of people. And the more confidence you get, the closer you get in, and at some point somebody nods to you and you either take a break or you shake it off and keep gaining confidence. But I've known people who've gone an entire festival season never getting closer than the outside of a picking circle, because they were really just gaining the confidence to play anything with other people. So that's actually a pretty good way to develop experience playing with live people. And just work your way, work your confidence up until you feel like you can get what it is you want, that you can get in and actually play. Yeah.
Is it too basic to ask you to just briefly review the vamping?
Oh, absolutely not.
I don't think it's that bad.
Actually, this is the first time in three camps I haven't taught a class specifically on vamping.
I don't think I really know the basics of it.
Okay.
Is that okay to ask?
Yes, absolutely okay to ask. I'm just trying to figure out how much time. What time is it over? 5 o'clock? Oh, easy. Sure. Okay. Vamping in six steps. Okay. The idea of vamping is that you're trying to keep rhythm, but you're trying to do it in a way that doesn't inject too much music into the groove. If you're doing a lot of open chords, yeah, just imagine 10 banjos doing that. It's just too much stuff, and trying to sing over that or play over that. So the first thing about vamping is that you're always going to vamp with closed chords. You control. Right? You're always going to vamp in a way that you can stop your notes from ringing whenever you want. So any open strings you play are not going to be able to stop them. So the first thing is you're going to work. And the second thing is you're not going to use bar chords.
You can,
but in vamping bar chords, the inversion, the way that the notes relate to each other, it's the least assertive, or the least interesting of the three chord shapes for vamping. Yeah, that's got a. That's pretty good. Yeah, it's a little weak. So you're going to use the D and F shapes for vamping. Okay, so make a G chord at the fifth fret. So come up two frets.
Rich,
yeah.
Is that common terminology? Fifth fret is your lowest finger.
That's the way I do it. There are some people who do the lowest fret number. I tend to do the highest fret number. Because when you're looking from over here, that's the one you see. Well, I call it fifth. I won't take credit for doing the popular thing here. Okay, so play it. You're at the third, fourth, and fifth frets. That's unambiguous. And so just play it, and you're covering all four strings. So your ring finger is out on the fourth string. And so step one of vamping is you're going to play on the quarter note beat. So one, two, three, four. On one, you're going to play the fourth string with your thumb. On two, you're going to pick up with your index and middle fingers on the first and second strings. You're playing the D shape, so switch to the F shape. So switch to the F. Okay, so that's the first step. And that's almost a vamp right there. And you just do that over and over and over again. So one, two, three, four. Okay.
What's going on with the third string?
What's that?
What's going on with the third string?
I'll get to that. That's step three. Okay. Step two. This is just as bad as this, right? So you want to be able to stop all those strings. The way you do that, it's really simple. Simpler than it seems like it should be. After you play, relax your hand. And what will happen is that the tension of the strings will push your fingers away from the frets. You don't have to lift. You don't have to do any muscle movement. You just relax your hand, and the chord will stop. Your fingers are still on the strings, so they're going to damp the strings. As soon as the strings are off the frets, they'll stop making noise. So here we are now. We're going to do fourth string and let it sustain. And then you're going to do the up pick and relax your hand. Okay. Keep going. I'm here. Sounds good. Okay.
You're relaxing right after you up pick.
Right. Now here's, you can stop now and let me explain that when you relax your hand, you have a choice of when to do that, right? If you do it the moment you up pick, you end up with a very aggressive sound because it's chop and it's done. If you want things to sound a little mellower, let the note, let the chord ring a little bit. And that softens that, that the edge of that D. There are times you actually lift your fingers before you do the uptick. And you get a really tight sound on the backbeat, so the 2 and the 4, which is when you're doing the uptick.
Are you just pitching the first and second string?
I'm sorry?
Are you just pitching the
first and second? It's index and note.
Yes,
Okay, now step 3, because both of you kind of touched on it. We haven't done anything with the third string yet. Here's what I want you to do. When you uptick, you're playing the first string with your middle, second string with your index. You want to brush. You want to pull that. You want to keep that finger down, so that you play each of those fingers plays 2 strings. So that your index finger is going to play the second and third string. That's just my index finger. Try that. It takes a little practice to get that control. Right? Your middle finger is going to play the first and second strings. That's just my middle finger. So, right. So when you play, you're playing all 3 strings. You're playing the first, second, and third string on that uptick with 2 fingers. And you're actually playing the second string twice. And what that gives you is a much fuller chord sound. And almost a little bit of an echo sound. Right, there's slow motion. And when you do it quickly. Let me play this 2 ways. I'm doing this with 2 fingers now, doing that drag. Okay, now I'm gonna do it with a 3 finger pinch. I'm just gonna use the thumb on the third string. You hear how much thinner that sounds? As opposed to, the idea of a vamp is that you're filling space, you're marking time. And so you want that statement to be as big as possible, even if it's only going to last that long. You still want it to be big while it's there. Right. You want people to blink when they hear that. You go to the Scruggs book, and he talks about vamping, and he does the thumb on every beat. He just moves the thumb back and forth from the 4th string to the 3rd. So he's doing a pinch. Doesn't give you the full sound, plus it starts speeding up and your thumb gets pretty darn busy. Where if you're doing this, everything's balanced. You just go back and forth. You can play crazy fast. You can play faster than you'd ever want to play. And remember, every note you're playing in the band is 2 notes of banjo music. It's 2 8th notes. So whatever I'm doing here, imagine playing twice that fast. It doesn't happen. But it's a much better sound. Okay, that's step 3. Step 4, we also haven't talked about the 5th string. And that's a problem. 5th string is not usually a problem on the banjo, but listen to this. You have to be quiet for this demonstration. But listen. What's happening? Right. I've got all 4 of these strings covered, right? There's nothing happening.
It's resonance.
It's resonance. It's the sympathetic vibration of the banjo pushing energy into the 5th string and making it vibrate. So when everything else stops, 5th string is still vibrating. So we've got to stop the 5th string. Because when you start playing D chords, you hear it? It's just wrong. It's not as loud because the vibrations aren't at the right frequency, but it's still there. So here's what I want you to do for this. This is going to sound a little strange, but move away from the bridge. And right here, this part of your palm, the outside of your palm, rests on the fifth string. So what you're doing is you're used to having this arch in your right hand to get down to the strings. You're actually going to let your wrist break backwards so that you can actually rest the front part of your palm, the thumb part of your palm, on the head of the banjo. And that'll get this part of your palm in the right place. This is going to be very quick, but I'm going to do this, and when I lift, you're going to see a light spot on my skin where the fifth string is pushing in. Ah, that was too fast. Yeah, I looked at it and it was already going. So that's the spot that you want on the fifth string. It doesn't have to be hard. It doesn't take much to keep the string from vibrating. But you do that, and instead of this, right, you get this. Right, nothing.
Constantly resting on it?
Constantly resting on it, right. And so that really locks your hand into a position. But that locks your hand, you know, you've got your forearm on the armrest, you've got the front of your wrist down on the head of the banjo, you've got this part of your palm against the fifth string. Then nothing can move but your fingers. So it's another good opportunity for those circles. I'll go one step further on step five. I said this was a six-step process. I actually lied. It's a five-step process. At least today it is. I never know when I start this how many steps I'm actually going to put into. To do this over and over again is, in a word, boring. Right? Not only boring for you, it just makes the music sound a little bit monotone. It's like hearing a bass just play the same note over and over again. It's great for effect, but after half a tune, you're ready to hear a new note. So with a lot of instruments, with instruments that have a lot of range, you can vary the bass note. On banjo, you can't do that because you don't have a string down there. Like on guitar, you can alternate bass notes. On banjo, your bass note's always going to be the fourth string. So in order to vary the bass note, you have to vary where you're playing the fourth string. So that's a G chord. The next G chord up in pitch is up here. Ninth fret, 7, 8, and 9. Right. So here's this is the last step, and this is actually, you do this and you've pretty much got a professional grade band. That sounds terrible. Never mind. What an idea. So what you're going to do is you're going to play your vamp down here at 5. Move your ring finger up to 9. Put down a D-shaped chord. Do the vamp again. As soon as you're done there, move back down to 5. Do it again. And just over and over again. This is going to be, and I saved this for last, and made it a separate step for a very specific reason. You can get by just fine not doing this. Right? You can just play one chord. It makes your vamp more interesting, but this is going to take a lot of practice to get it to work. But once you're there, this is what you got. And then, till the chord changes. Great. Was that your question? Yeah. I saw it in your eyes.
Right.
What you do with when the chord changes to C, you want to do exactly the same thing. This is a closed position, right? There are no open strings in what you're doing here, which means you can move it anywhere on the neck. If I move this whole thing up 2 frets, that's an A chord, right? Going from G to A. I have to move the high position up 2 frets also. That's another A chord. So, do the same vamp. Now it's an A vamp. Back down G, F. So, normally the chords we're concerned about are G, C, and D. So, you want to find that chord shape, that F chord shape, where you can make a C chord with that shape. Where can you do that? 10. 8, 9, 10. So there's your C vamp. If you're not doing the alternation, that's all you need. If you're not doing the alternation, though, that means that you're going to go from G down here at 5, all the way up here to C at 10 in one beat. If you are doing the alternation, you're going to go from 10 to 14. So there's your C band. D is 2 frets above C. So there's your D band. And here's where doing the alternation really kind of helps you. Because if you're doing the C, if you're doing the G alternation, and it's time to go to C, you're 1 fret away. So that's a nice transition. You're at the high point in C, you only come halfway back to go to D. And now from D, right before you go back to G, instead of going up here, you go down here, and G is 1 fret away. So it's nice. Here's what's happening when you do these chord, these different chord shapes. What you're really doing is taking the same scale, right? The same. You know, you're looking at G. G. If you're doing these chords, G is here. If you're doing a bar chord, you know, A, B, C, and so on. If you're doing a bar chord, G is here. A, B, C. Now you're here, where you are G, when you're playing the F shape. Now you're playing C. You do D shape, D is here, that's E flat. So depending on your chord, on the chord you're making, that spot is either G, C, or E flat. And everything else moves up and down from. So what's going to happen is all the chord combinations you use, all the ones you know and love, there are going to be places where you can find that chord progression, those two chords, really close together. And if you can find that, it becomes really easy to change chords. If you're,
it's just a matter of practice.
It's just a matter of practice. Actually, you can think of this as an easier way to do the vamp. If you're just starting out and you want to do one position, don't use this G. Use this G. So you do that G, and you go to C, it's just 1 fret up. D is 2 frets up from there, and then back 3 frets to G. So you go 1, 2, 3. So that's all it is. So there's a well-being path on this old mountainside. So the punk rock version, right? So you've got everything within this really short stretch of neck that you need to vamp a 3-chord song.
On 14.
Yeah.
That's the D or the F position.
On 14, that's the F. That's the D position. That's C chord in the D position, in the D shape. this is the perfect example of how this works. Right, the most common chord progression in music. 5-1. So D shape, move up one fret, go to an F shape. That's 5-1. Do that anywhere on the neck. Remember I said you get used to anything? Well, right, let me do this in some weird place. Right, that sounds really natural now. All of a sudden G sounds like this really dissonant chord. And that's what I'm saying. You get used to the sound, and it works or it doesn't work. So there's a... That'll hopefully help you all damn when you're jamming tonight. Yeah.
Sorry for all these questions.
Yeah, absolutely. No. It's great.
I've been to a bunch of jams, but I don't participate. I go to... The only one that is near me is a very advanced jam.
Okay.
So I kind of sit in the corner.
That's tough, yeah.
I sit in the corner, I'm kind of quiet, and there's two guitar players.
Yeah.
One guy, I can read his fingers.
Okay.
The guy is all over the place. I can't read his fingers. The next problem is, how do you know when the chord change is happening fast enough?
Okay, this is... this is going to be repeat for you from last session, but here's a really important practice technique, and this has nothing to do with banjo, although you can practice it on the banjo. What's key to really knowing your way around a song is being able to hear both the chord progression and the melody. So, in bluegrass, we work in a pretty limited world. Right? You learn three chords, and you know everything you know, everything you need to play 90% of the music. And the chords themselves don't matter as much as the relationship between the chords. So, if I play... there's a well-beaten path on this old mountainside. Right, you hear that interval. If I capo up to play this in A, and I play there's a well, and notice I'm playing exactly the same things I played before. I've shortened the neck by two. So I can do there's a well-beaten path on this old mountainside. Is that the same thing I played before? Yeah, it sounds the same. Except... Is that the same? Yeah. From a point of view of the song, the particular notes don't matter. What matters is the relationship between them. Is getting... from where you're starting... getting to the next thing. And so if you can hear that relationship, it's going to sound the same to you no matter what key is being played in. So first of all, you think, you know, there's lots of frets, there's lots of notes. How do I find my way around? But you don't have to worry about things changing. The world doesn't change when you change keys. So you've got three chords, you've got six ways that you can change from one to another. That's all you need to hear. So when you're listening, try to listen to songs you don't know, bluegrass songs. Now I want to keep it within this little universe, and hear where the chord changes are. Somebody in the last session said, I just keep playing until it sounds bad, and then I know there's a chord change. And that can kind of work, but only for you. So you listen for chord change, and you react to it if it's already happened. You listen sometimes for your chords to start to have a little bit of an odd sound to them. So if I do that, I'm not going to stay there, right? You can hear that. Plus, you know where I'm going to go. I'm going to go there. Right? So G to there takes me to C. There's only three places this can go, right? It can go to C, it can go to D, or it can go back to C, back to G, rather. So I can go... That sounds a little strange. That sounds strange, too. Okay? So you practice listening to these things. You know, here's the paradox of music. You've been listening all your life. And so there are things that you know are right just from experience. They're rules, right? And they're in your head, whether you like it or not, whether you understand them or not. You can tell the difference between good music and bad music, or between music that follows the rules and music that doesn't. I won't do the good and bad value judgment, because there's good music that deliberately breaks the rules, but not in bluegrass. So what you want to do is connect with what you already know. There are two places you need to do that, and this is one. One is understanding the relationship between those three chords and how to hear them, and how to hear when that's happening as opposed to when that's happening. Because then you can... It's the same relationship. And so that's what you hear. As soon as you hear that first note, as soon as you hear the first note of Cabin Home on the Hill, there's a well, there's a well-beaten path on this old mountainside. You know how to sing the rest of it. If I do this, there's a well-beaten path on this old mountainside. After that first note, it sounds like exactly the same song. So you want to listen for how chords change. You also want to hear how notes change. So that's different from that. It's because in one case the notes are further apart than the other. Also different from this, because the notes are going down in pitch rather than going up. And these are, like I said, these are all things that you already know. You just don't know how you know them. And the proof of that is that if I asked you to sing a song right now, if I picked a song you actually know and said, sing it for me, you'd be able to sing it. And all the notes would be there, and all the intervals would be right. And the other thing is timing, because you have to know not only what note's coming next, but how long it's going to last. And that's something that banjo players in particular have a hard time hearing, because you're sort of focused on what's happening with your right hand, and you're playing things that are deliberately out of time, right? The music's going 1 2 3 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4. You're going 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3. They don't match, and you can't count off your fingers. Because there's three notes in a forward roll, there are eight notes in a measure. So how many times do you play a forward roll to fit two measures? Right, there's no halves. Right, we've got to talk thirds there. So you can't do that. But what you can do is, if I, you play John Hardy, you're really getting a repeat now. You play John Hardy, and at the end of John Hardy is this really long D chord. You ought to see John Hardy get away, Lord. You ought to see John Hardy get away. How do you know when to go to that G chord? Well, if you're counting, you'll never get it. Okay, where am I? But if you sing the song to yourself, if you sang the song right now, you would come off of that D at exactly the right place. I guarantee you. So when you're playing, this is again something you have to practice, and it's hard to do because at this level, you're so concentrated on playing the right thing. But at the same time you're playing, you've got to be singing the song to yourself. And if you do that, Odyssey, John Hardy, get away, Lord, Lord. Odyssey, John Hardy, get away. You knew exactly when that G was coming. And I played exactly the same thing I played the last time when it was impossible to follow. So in your head, you got the song. And then this is actually another coping mechanism. This is something I hadn't gotten to yet, but it's good that we talked about it now. At the center of everything you play, by yourself or with a group, is the song. The only difference is when you're playing with a group, all of you should be singing the same song at the same time. And that's what makes you all fit together. But whether you're playing with a group or by yourself, it's the song that's going to keep you on the beat. It's going to keep you knowing when things are going to happen. And so as you practice, again, by yourself or in a jam session, you have got to keep the song, sing the song to yourself. People talk, I've heard other people here talk, so you've got to hum the song. And to me, humming doesn't work, because humming can be just as featureless as this. But if you're saying, oh, say it, John Hardy, get away, Lord, Lord. You ought to see John Hardy, get away. You're right there. You know what to do. You know what to do it. And all you're doing is calling on stuff that you've known how to do for probably since you were four. Right? When you were four, you could sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And at least my 3.5-year-old grandson can. So I'm extrapolating
it
back.
It just seems hard. It just seems so hard.
It does, because it's like you've got the song over here and you've got the banjo over here, and you're trying to drive them down the track in parallel and have them match, and you can't. It's almost literally impossible to do. If you can do that, you've got such good technique that when you bring things together, they're really going to work. But you've got to have everything going on at the same time in order for it to work. And that's probably the best jam session preparation you can do, is just get used to singing the song in your head while you play. And by the way, the first songs people learn on banjo are generally instrumentals. Instrumentals have melodies, whether they have words or not. A lot of them that aren't taught as having words actually do. We just don't sing them anymore. But even Foggy Mountain, Foggy Mountain Breakdown. So you can even sing that in your head, right? If a song does have words, if you're playing Fireball Mail, go research the words. Learn for songs that you know you're going to be playing fairly often. If you're in a jam session with the same people, they say play the same songs every week. Go out, find them on YouTube, learn a verse and a chorus. That'll give you something in your head to go through. Plus, you might find you have a talent for singing harmony, and then you'll have the words to chorus, and you'll be able to do it.
Does that suggest that maybe if you learn a new song, to start with the melody, add the chords, maybe do backup, and then finally come to a break?
I actually like that. I like that process.
Can you say that again?
You start with the melody, and actually you start with the melody and the chords together. You figure out how they go together. I just did a whole session on this, and on how to put the two together, but that's something to learn on your own. When you learn to play the song, you've come from a place where you know what's behind it. You know what's behind the notes you're playing, and it'll make more sense. The other thing that happens if you get lost, if you make a mistake in a jam session, the jam session plows right on ahead. You can't capture that back. But what you can do is because you know what's coming, you can find a place where you know how to start, and jump back in there.
So sometimes the head guy will say, doesn't want to know that much. He'll say, okay, key of A, 1, 5, 4, 1.
Okay, yeah. And that's,
then you're supposed to know when there's a 1 and 5,
right.
And 4 and a 1.
And that's called the national numbers, and that's a convenient way to have everyone, to tell everyone what the chords are at the same time, whether or not you've changed keys, and whether or not some people in the group are capoed and others aren't. So you capo up 2, and for you, A is G. But for the fiddle player and the mandolin player, A is still A. And so if that's the 1 chord, the guy says 1, and everybody translates it properly. I have a website that I actually just freshened. I've got my interview will be in Banjo Newsletter next month, which I'm very happy about. But I figured I'd better put some content out there since people will actually be visiting.
Who did the interview?
Sumner Blunt did the interview. He's here. So I actually wrote an article on this exactly this topic, and I think I call it "Coloring Your Way to Better Banjo Playing." And the idea is you take a tune. Hopefully, I still have a copy. I may have used all these. I may have taught all those classes already. There's one. So if you're starting with tablature, tablature is featureless, right? It doesn't tell you when to play loud, when to play soft. It doesn't tell you dynamics at all. But in that tablature, buried in that tablature is melody. So what I suggest is take your tablature and take a highlighter and find the melody notes. And just highlight the melody notes. So that when you've done that, if you've done that, and all of my tab that's relevant to melody, I put highlighted notes on the melody. I put those little yellow boxes around them. And what it does for you is when you're playing the tab, you see those highlights and you just naturally play those notes a little louder. Plus, if you know the melody of the song, you'll just hear which are the melody notes and you'll naturally play them louder. So you're further along the way of learning the tune. Plus, just the process of putting the highlighted notes in place, it gives you the melody. It forces you to learn the melody. Going somewhere with that. So if you're playing "This Land Is Your Land," you know, "Little Darling Pal of Mine," you might play it really, really even like that, and you know it's a little, you know, I told you what it was, so I sort of warned you where the melody notes were because you know the song. But if you didn't know what the song was, you wouldn't know much about what was going on there. Right, the quarter notes give you a lot of clue, but for the rest of the tune, no. But if you... The melody, you bring the melody out, you make it come out, and you get two things. You get people actually understand the song you're playing. That's really a good thing. But also you hear the rhythm that the melody notes happen in, because when you're playing three finger rolls, that melody is going to be syncopated. You don't have to do any work to do this. It's happening. Right, and you're creating this little push that happens because that melody isn't right. It's not every time you play a note you tap your foot. It's sometimes the notes happen in between the taps, and that that grabs people's attention. They're not used to that. They're not expecting. And when you're playing, when you're just playing notes, it's pretty, but it doesn't really advance the tune. It's Earl's Breakdown. Right, you hear that? And instead of right, it's a more exciting sound. And I'm not playing anything different. Like if I looked at the tablature, that it's the same tablature for both of us. But it's all emphasis. Play the index and middle finger notes strong, and the thumb weak, and a rhythm comes out of that just isn't there when you're playing everything even. And when you're playing a tune with melody, which, as I said, is just about every tune, you get both at once. You get melody, you get cool rhythm. It sounds like a banjo. So, let me just make sure. Oh, there's one more thing. I never get to this when I do this class, but I'm gonna just hit you with this last page.
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, I got by my watch 20 seconds. So I can cover this in 20 seconds. Oh, 15. Never mind. So here's a little bit of a hint. When you're playing your own breaks. Something that will make them sound more convincing, even if you have no idea what you're doing. The downbeat measure of the downbeat of the first measure of any melody will almost always be one of the notes in the chord that's being played at that point. Let me demonstrate. That's a really kind of abstract concept, but I can make it make sense. If you're playing a song in bluegrass, 90% of the songs in bluegrass are G, C, and D. 90% of those start on the one chord. So start on the G chord if you're in G. There are three notes in a G chord, G, B, and D. And on the banjo, you get a bonus D and a bonus G. So you got five notes, but they're all G, B, and D. Any bluegrass song that you choose to name, chances are, after the pickup notes, da, 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 that first note that happens on the first beat of the first full measure is going to be G, B, or D. So, just go through the notes. So, if I had the wings of an angel, down the road from me there's an old holly tree. Da, da, da. Will the circle be unbroken? Well, don't forget me, little darling, we're growing old and gray. I'm drawing a blank on B. Trust me, there's lots of... Well, anyway... that'll take too many of my 15 seconds. So what I've given you here is lead-ins for those pickup notes to each of the five strings. So if you're playing a tune that starts on that note, use and it almost doesn't matter what you play after that. You sold the tune right there. Right, and I'm just playing generic rolls after that. But starting on the right note will make people much more convinced that you know what you're doing. So memorize those 10 measures. I think I gave you an alternate for the fourth string. or and that works. So another confidence builder. There's nothing like getting through the first measure and a little bit of a song, and feeling like, okay, I got this. It'll make it much easier to keep that momentum going and feel like you're playing something. Plus, the stronger you come in, the more people are gonna stop and listen. Right? It's really tough if you just kind of play something and people aren't sure whether you're actually taking the break or not. So this gives you some things you can play with confidence that will get you through the first 3.5 seconds of any tune.
Quick question. I was always under the impression on the vamp.
Yeah.
First, second, third were the thumb. Not so you.
That's what
second, third.
That's what. Yeah. And I was saying that you can do that. You get a thinner sounding chord because you're only playing the second string once. You don't get the little echo that you get from that. Plus, if you're playing fast, that's your thumb's doing a lot of work. It's not balanced, right? You're just doing this, and there's nothing going on with your other fingers to balance it. If you do this, it's balanced. So you can play much faster.
Brushing the second and third with the index finger?
Brushing the second and third with the index, and the first and second with the middle.
First time I ever heard that, I thought it was just three.
Yeah, it's something. It's not the way the Scruggs would teach it. But I talked to Ross, talk to anybody who's performing here, and ask them how they vamp, or just watch tonight. It's easy to watch people's thumbs because they've generally got these gaudy pieces of plastic on them. So just watch their thumbs when they're vamping, and you're going to see that instead of. You can see how much more movement there is in that, and just movement's the energy of is the enemy of good banjo playing. The more you move, the harder it is to get all those movements into a short space.
Excuse me, no, I've never heard that.
Yeah. Okay, so thanks for coming.
This is great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to introduce myself. I was actually going to take your adult ed class that was canceled a month ago. I'm Morgan. Do you do anything? Jams or
I don't do jams. I just don't have the time. I wish I did.
But I work full time.
I will be, and I think it'll probably go to a place where I can be a little more concerned about getting a minimum.
Okay.
That
would be very
interesting. Okay. The next round will be in September. It's overwhelming, and there's a lot going on.
In a way, and even it's not a complaint. It's phenomenal. Even if you learn like the various positions, the C's and G's, up and down, it's the way you learn it. Now all of a sudden they say, "Hey, table we're down to." Well, it's not the same place anymore.
Right. Let me show you something.
I'd be really beginning to appreciate
right.
this.
This is a trick I show sometime in this class, and I just didn't have time to get to it. Your position markers will show you where you have to go. So if you keep the recorder going too, so it'll be on the recording anyway. Like I said, I've named the positions by the highest fret. So this G is a fifth fret G. So if you look at those fingers and the position markers. Every time those fingers line up on position markers, you're playing an important chord. So.
Oh, you mean these guys?
Right.
Okay.
So this is G, that's F. Right?
Right.
Right, so F, G, A, C. D.
Right.
Right. F, keep going. F, This works for every single one of them. F, G.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah.
Because the,
that's gonna be
the, my position marker is always the one down, up the neck.
Okay.
Because I'll call this I'll call that fret number, but it's that one, and they're they're agreeing with you.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
So yeah, the run one's at the top, right? That's the one.
Yeah.
Right. So that's A. That's G. That's where am I?
It's G.
No. Oh yeah. Right. A. C.
And no man's land down here.
Well, the only one that doesn't work is the gold tone block, which isn't really a position marker.
No,
it gets better. Go to a D position, and the same thing works for the fret behind the position marker. So that's D. This is actually C. Now you don't need this finger. D, E. G, A, C, same progression as before. C,
right.
D,
very
E, and G.
There.
Right. So now, when you're vamping, or when you need to find a chord, if it's an F-shaped chord, go for the marks. If it's a D-shaped chord, go for the marks and miss by one.
Right.
And when you capo, the nice thing about this is because of the way things are spaced, it mostly still works if you're an A. So in A, I'm gonna say capo names instead of actual names. So I'm gonna call this G, even though it's actually A. But if you're playing a song capo, you're gonna think of that as a G chord.
So it's right over here.
Right. So now you've got F, G. Okay, B flat, not so good. C.
I lost my tracking over there because this is a. Here, this is a G. A, B, C should be over there, right?
Right. So you're. Okay, you're on that. Okay, you're backwards.
Yeah,
you're on the D shape.
I think this just takes a lot of work to make it second nature with the two shapes.
It absolutely does. Yeah.
I mean, I know them. I just don't know them.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, you have to get really friendly with them.
You were
recorded? Okay.